Now that's a parking spot.
Introducing the I may have underestimated the size of my car policy with accident forgiveness from American Family Insurance. Insure carefully. Dream fearlessly. Get a quote. Find an agent. Visit AmFam.com.
Optional policy features not included in base policies. Review policy for coverages and exclusions. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Welcome to Audio Gyan with Kedar Nimkar, a podcast that documents insightful conversations with Indian designers, artists, musicians, writers, thinkers, and creatives of all types. Catch us on iTunes or visit audiogyan.com for more Gyan sessions. Here's your host, Kedar Nimkar.
1 billion people, 15% of world's population, world's largest minority. They are underserved. They are disheartened. We had to do something because no one deserves to be alone. And this is what is written on the About Us section of inclove.in. Today, I have Kalyani Khona with us on AudioGAN. Kalyani works at the intersection of behavior, design, technology to build products. Currently, she is helping with product strategy for an early age startup in the fintech space. But today we are here to discuss a case study of her own startup, Inclove. Kalyani is, was the co-founder of Inclove, the world's first matchmaking app for people with disability and health disorders to find love. The app matches people on the basis of care availability, medical condition, level of independence, lifestyle choices, and many more. I was curious to know many aspects of this project, including the UI, and here she is with us today. There are also some really good TEDx and Inc talks, which I'm going to add in the show notes below. So thank you, Kalyani, for giving your time, and it's a real, real honor to have you on AudioGAN.
Thanks, Kedar. Likewise.
Yeah. If you can give like a basic context of what's the status with InCloud today and your association? We'll start there and then we'll go into more deeper questions.
Sure. This is like we were talking a little earlier that it's been a year that InCloud's closed. We had to shut it down, unfortunately. And this is after a year that I'm going on record to talk about my experiences. So I'm really looking forward to it because a lot of it is nostalgia. And a lot of it is actually something I'd leave as notes and legacy because I never really wrote about what really went through the whole story. But it's a story of 6 years, and there's like massive learning, massive level of experiments that went right, wrong. Some reached the global stage, like we gave a keynote at United Nations about this as an Indian project that is innovative and could be implemented by a lot of other developed and developing nations. So, yeah, I'm really kind of looking forward to it. But to answer your question, we had to close down InCloud last year around same time.
If you can start by saying, so what is InCloud and why did you start it?
So InCloud actually stands for inclusive love. If you combine these two topics, then or these two topics, and I'll come to why I'm saying these two topics, but like the intersection of inclusion and love was what was the core idea behind it. And there are like, as per United Nations, are like 80 million people in India, and this was like 10 years back. Like that's the earliest report I could get on an Indian number from cited by a global organization. So right now you could easily count that as another 100 million people with disability living in India. The only reason I feel it's much easier to explain this problem today is because we're all confined to our homes and we hate that. Like we don't have a choice to be able to do what we want to right now because of a amoeba atom that's kind of paralyzed the whole world. Think of it in a similar analogy that there are 100 million people in India who, not just because of COVID, but otherwise genetic or medical condition, go through this same confinement, but across their lifetime. So you and I have been confined for, let's say, 4 to 5 months now. But think of this 100 million people confined to their homes or to their whatever space they are right now in for lifetime without much physical or external kind of interaction with the rest of the world. And that's the exact problem statement that I started out with in 2014. We were much earlier of our time. I got to realize this only much later. But back then, even like the top five internet companies of the world weren't looking at disability or accessible technology in the same way that probably some of them do now. And so that's one side, which is like physical spaces not being accessible. But the same story carried forward on the internet as well. So internet as a network is actually made for people who are highly functional human beings, like for people whose all five senses and hands and legs are mobile. But that's not the case with all of us, right? Like most of us, and it could be because of age or medical condition again, that we don't find the all five senses in same coordination all the time. For that particular group, physical was, of course, no option, but even the internet was highly unsuitable. So they lived with this 1+4 network, I call, which is 1+ their 4 family members or one of their friends, and that's their world. So the fundamental question was, how do you expand their world? And it's not really about just matchmaking or marriage or dating, but how do you bring more people into their lives that overall just brings more experiences? And experiences, of course, then leads to many things, and marriage or dating could be one of that. Rightly said, it was actually a project that I took up after my college thinking something interesting may come out of it. It was just mostly answering to my curiosity. And then I realized, hey, that is actually a very big problem statement, because when I set out, I got people from all parts of the world, not just India, reaching out to me and saying, this is something we resonate with, and there is nothing that is actually solving it. So back in 2014, I just put this page on the internet saying a solution like this should exist. It was called Project Lovability at that time, like ability to love. And so I just put that, and I put like $10,000 as my target. And I said, if I reach $10,000, I'll just make this app. You know, this app can really just help people. So, I went ahead with that, and I just put the page, and within like 15 to 20 days, I reached $10,000, and it sunk upon me that I'm supposed to now actually put this to life. We're talking about times when crowdfunding was not mainstream. We're talking about time when dating apps were not mainstream. This is 2013-14, almost like 7 years, 8 years back. So then I did that, and then, you know, one thing led to another. We built this app. We got our first 5,000 users very, very easily. And in fact, like the day we launched, within 10 days of the launch, a couple met and they decided to get married. So we felt like this is early success. And, you know, everything was right in terms of MVP, product market fit, the traditional ways of like how we think of product roadmap, everything felt right, went well. We were actually making this piece of technology that if we go right with, it would be the core infra, and you could build so many services on top of it. So we were like, hey, we are solving the problem of matchmaking, but we also want to make this technology accessible to as many other services who want to build on top of it. I was just 21 back then. So with whatever limited knowledge, me and my co-founder, I had a co-founder, Shankar, with whatever limited knowledge both of us could put together, we kind of went ahead. The app went live. People started getting married. And that's, I would call that as the phase one of InClove, where we felt like here's the hypothesis and got validated. And a year and a half from there, we raised some funds as well. We had some amazing investors, like they're so amazing. But they supported us from Google, Intel, you name it. And And so we reached the second phase, and some people called us and said, hey, you've created this app, but we're not able to meet in person. Like, you know, every place we go to is inaccessible. And if four people have to lift me on my wheelchair and put me in a cafe, I've already lost the battle to impress her. And, you know, this is not going to work out because she thinks now that I always need people to, you know, like get me from one place to another. So I said, that's a very genuine problem statement. And so we kind of did a lot of things on the experimentation side. But the one that went right is to convert these spaces that are already either accessible or would benefit from being accessible first. So instead of going to every public space and saying, hey, why are there no ramps here, which is also the bottom to top approach, we said, 5-star hotels and a lot of cafes by the premiumness that they have to be inclusive to be able to be a brand that resonates with everyone. So let's make those things accessible, or let's talk to their founders. And so then we were able to get the Lalit Group, which is Kitty Sue, one of like the top 100 in the world that recounts by the DJ Mag. And then we got the Lemon Tree. There were a lot of cafes also. Imperfecto, and we had a set of 10 to 15 spaces we could identify pan India, like those that if we cracked could be available in every city for us. And we started hosting meetups there. The meetups are called social spaces. They were quite a hit. I think there were people who thought social spaces is the company and InClub is something that is distinctively different from it. But that happened, and I think that was the moment that happened where everyone who either got married through us or met somebody through us said, we want to host a social space for you in Ahmedabad, in Udaipur, in Sultanpur. You know, like it just amplified. So that's, I know the introduction went for a little long. That's like what I'm talking about as what InClub stood for. In my mind, it still stands for is trying to do something different for people who are very different from you and me, who live very differently, and in a time where all of this was not actually an expectation.
Wow, it's very, very inspiring. So what I've done is I've broken down the conversation into two sections. One is sort of a product understanding or product strategy to the overall app or project or the digital manifested version of it. And then the second is the design aspect of it. Mm-hmm. So in product, what I would say is that, so in AudioGAN's 130th episode, I met Upasana Makati. Mm-hmm. So she is a founder of White Print, which is also like India's first English lifestyle magazine in Braille. Mm-hmm. So for visually impaired. And in our conversation, I asked her that, why lifestyle? I mean, and to which she had a very nice answer that, why can't these people have just fun while reading? Why, especially these visually impaired, generally get texts or something which is educational in nature. They won't have like a poem or a joke, or I don't know, like there is no fun angle to their reading experience. So that's why she consciously took this effort of making it a lifestyle sort of a magazine. So on same lines, there are like many problems, and the one which we started, that calling them disabled is like the least of a problem, but there are many. So why did you think matchmaking you picked up as a problem and not say support in any other way?
Yeah. So two sides of answers for this. One, that like I said, there were many problems, but the easier one to create a moat out of, where you can mobilize a community that you can then build services for, was matchmaking. But like, I'll give you a more back then, a 22-year-old's thinking on why matchmaking. Like, so what I did know back then was that if there is this one person and then there's this other person, then let's say there are these 100 people, a network of 100 people, does Kalyani want to go and empower or help each one of them individually? Or is it easier that Kalyani just connects A to B because both of them have had similar journeys, like-minded people live in the vicinity of each other, probably went to, let's say, for hypothetical reasons, same school, who help each other. And so if you couple these two people who you think would connect, they all, you know, help each other's lives or lifestyles and you know, kind of bring about change. So back then, like 7 years ago, I personally felt that if you help someone find a person they get along with, then you're not just doing change that requires a day, or Kalyani is not just giving talk on the stage, but she's actually making sure InClub's presence goes to each household, which actually has happened. Because when you combine these two people, every morning they're waking up, they're knowing that they are together, or they are helping each other, or things are very blissful in their lives right now compared to how they were when they were surviving alone, is probably because of this thing called InClub that brought them together. So the simple answer is scalability on bringing change was much easier here compared to other projects where if I was into employment or any other space, and really amazing NGOs exist in that space. Nobody was looking at matchmaking. But otherwise as well, if I were to do this on one-to-one basis, it would take me much longer to solve a problem versus connecting two people and letting them solve each other's problems together, or probably they have the same problem, so it makes sense that they all collaborate on it together. So like mobilizing on the collective power or empathy of like-minded people was a much better strategy for me than for somebody like me who has not witnessed their problem, actually even in their physical space or otherwise, telling them what to do about their lives.
Interesting. And also, I'm sure at 21, 22, you wouldn't really venture into like a operational heavy kind of a project. It's more like a experiment which you can at least get insights about that domain.
Yeah, actually, you know, now I think about what is operationally heavy and not. Back then, when I was just a BCom graduate out from my financial markets course, I didn't know what is operationally heavy and not. Like, you know, OYO is operationally heavy today. When the guy started out, probably didn't think of it that way. So I honestly didn't think of it that way. But yes, for me, if there were X resources and a two-people team, what is it that can bring the maximum impact on ground? So back then, VC funding and all of that was not as accessible as it is today, which is why I always had to see, and I always see what my constraints are. And then with the change that I want to bring or impact I want to bring, what could my options look like? And it's more lateral thinking for me than going linear one after another to solve it. And with all of the constraints I had and with the problem in hand, I felt like, irrespective of the operation side, because social spaces was technically very operationally heavy, to be able to go to each, fly to each city, host a meetup, make the venue accessible, ramps, all of that, but like looked like an easier thing to do with the constraints I had compared to any other services.
Sure. Cool. Moving on to the next one is, I mean, the moment I stumbled upon this project and I shared with my team members at Book My Show, like one of the designers said, why do we want like a different app? Okay, why can't the existing app happen? But the connotation or the background was more really about the people and not really the accessibility or the UI part of it. It was more like, why can't these people generally be on these apps as well? Like maybe Tinder or Bumble. So what I read is that there is still a lot of, I don't know, stigma maybe about these people or calling them different. Or so what I want to ask you is that what were the like challenges that you faced, internal and external, while making this special app for these special people? I mean, was it onboarding these people? Was it giving them confidence of their data will be secure? Any insights there?
Yeah. By the way, just like FYI, like the reason stands for inclusive love is we had almost 20-25% of our user base, 25% of 50,000 people that we had who did not have disability. And last three marriages that I attended before InClub shut down, one of the partner did not have disability and the other one did, obviously. So it really was, and I'd come to that logic as well, but it was really an inclusive platform where We're saying it's designed to also bring people with disability. But hey, you as Kedar could also come to a meetup, and I as Kalyani could be. I know a few of my friends who just came to volunteer for the meetup and ended up finding someone for themselves. So that was one. But I'll tell you, like, a more specific answer on why can't they just be on any other app. We did a social experiment where we got few of my very close ones that I know with disability that I had found through crowdfunding campaign. And I told them, can you please be on these one? I gave one dating app to each of them. And I said, could you just see how this experience is for you? We also had some of them blog about that experience. Those that now have married through InClub, but back then we asked them to blog about their experiences. And it was either like, they had a chat with somebody, let's say on a dating app, and I don't name them, but the person on the other side did not know that this person is blind, or visually challenged. So this person just went along, and when they actually met, this guy asked him, why didn't you tell me you're blind? Who wants to be with a blind person? And just left, right, the date. But this person on the other side didn't know what the protocol is. Was this person supposed to say he or she is blind on the chat? Or were they supposed to meet and he was supposed to know? Because this person said, just like that guy may have a heart disease that he's not mentioned on the chat, I may have some other disease that I don't feel like mentioning on the chat. So when we met, I'd kept this for then. So these protocols of how you're supposed to actually talk to your counterpart and the sensitivity, which was mostly missing on the other side, where people were fully able and thought it was like a big deal to have a physical challenge brought to the table. And the second side was when on an average, I had a counterpart with some disability. We ran this dating app challenge where both of us were on the same phone and she'd put her profile picture as somebody on the wheelchair. The kind of reactions and questions she was asked versus I was asked, or the way both our chats went, hers would mostly end in, oh, it was great talking to you, but I don't see a future here. I want to meet. Right. And that's not because she was bad or she was any different on the compatibility level. They all just first wanted to match and get to know the curiosity of how she's physically challenged. And then beyond that, there was just more sympathy and they would bounce off. So these series of experiences and experiments that we did, and including I went to like these, matrimonial portals. And one of the newspapers actually covered that. I went to their office and they said, oh, we have so many profiles. We really don't have time to get this niche. So these technologies or these portals were not designed to encompass the vulnerabilities of people with disability A, but also B, the way they were designed, they didn't allow for that communication exchange of the disability or the person's full, full status through this. And lastly, like parents who called from these matrimonial portals to a person who's blind or on wheelchair would end up being like, beta bahut bura hua tumhare saath, shayad tumhare ghar kharab hai, and they would just keep the phone, right? So the way that they were treated on a public platform was much different than the way they were treated on InClub. And much later, I realized it's because InClub, being highly curated as a community that is so empathetic, they found this to be a safe space to be able to actually go out and be themselves and explore their sexuality, explore their dating experiences fully compared to on other platforms where they constantly felt judged. So it was just a function of design, information, and the kind of actual inclusion we brought that other portals, in spite of being inclusive, couldn't bring, is, I think, what led to that 50,000 people that got together. And whatever success we saw was because of these three things.
Wow. it's sometimes sad to know the state of things. And it's also very inspiring to know that what you tried to... I mean, I remember like one interview with Ashwini Deshpande. She said that the stairs... by which we came up is designed for like a 6 foot white male. That's all the stairs are designed for. Yeah. And I mean, it's that inaccessible in our country, especially.
Yeah, that's right. So, and which is why I think it clicked.
Yeah. I mean, it's, I don't know, is it
lack of empathy, because like Shaadi.com or Bharat Matrimony or these any of these big websites, they still don't have this sort of a section. Is it?
No, they do. I was surprised.
Back then it wasn't.
No, back then as well, it was. It was just a tick. Like, if you're having any disability out of the 350 disabilities that you have, physical, mental, intellectual, whatever disability you have, you're just supposed to tick box, I am physically challenged and I am not, which is so limited, and which is the part you brought, right, when you introduced that our application would ask what your intention is to be on this app, which could be friendship, dating, marriage, and then it would also ask what your disability is. Does that make sure you're independent or not? Does it have a cure? Does it not? How does this impact your office or your work life? Does it not? All of that actually gives a person on the other side very strong visibility of whether this would be a good fit or not, which the other websites didn't. Just by putting like a tick box is like on whether I'm disabled or not was like mere tokenism according to me. Which is I'm saying I went to their like offices and I spoke to people back then and I asked them why, you know, they weren't doing anything more about it. And the standard response was that it wasn't required. Like, you have so much to do and we have 1,000,000+ profiles. It was not a problem big enough for them.
And do you have any insight on when you go to apply to these international places, like, I don't know, maybe Intuit and like any big corporations where you apply, there's a form which in the end, it obviously with gender and nationality and race and ethnicity, they also have a drop down which says, are you disabled? I'm not disabled and I don't wish to disclose. There are just these three options.
Yeah.
So any insight as to why does the third option exist? I don't wish to disclose.
Oh, it's because you need to give them a choice. It's a very personal information that most people feel either will lead to biasness, like how you have racism. You also, if you're disabled, most people unfortunately relate it with lower productivity at workspace or may not choose or end up hiring that CV. The second side is that a lot of people with a lot of self-respect I know said we don't want to be a part of that quota, that 1% hiring quota for people with disability that you're supposed to follow as a corporation. So they mentioned that they do not wish to specify to make sure that they get selected on merit and not otherwise. It has both the sides of stories.
Wow.
And the reason I know employers ask this is, one, of course, they have the 1% or whatever, now it's changed, but that quota. But the second is they want to make sure, and I really respect that, they want to make sure their physical as well as internet infrastructure can actually accommodate for that disability. So I know of corporations who just hired people with cognitive disabilities, not for cerebral palsy, not fully realizing the kind of ecosystem they require to work, and then ended up like letting them go, which was bad for both the corporation as well as the person with disability, just because the infrastructure was not capable enough to support this collaboration.
Yeah.
Actually, this norm that, you know, we're an equal opportunities provider is like last 2 to 3 years. But before that, that didn't exist, which is, as I said, we were a little early in time, much early in time. Yeah.
I mean, I want to this part one of the conversation, I want to conclude with a more abstract question, but just to continue the earlier one. Like any particular big challenges that you faced while building this product? I mean, one that you mentioned about you reaching out to these matrimony sites and figuring out the state of things the way they are. But how did you like counter those in the app which you were building? Because I'm curious to know, and also in the talk, you said that it was all manually tagged. So if you can just share those insights somewhere.
Oh, this talk was, I think, 2015, after which we went algorithms and data. So do you want me to talk about challenges? Because my biggest challenge and that led to the failure as well, eventually, or whatever you call it, like, was the discovery of audience, actually, and not the design. And design could have been, it was solved. It did take a lot of more money, infrastructure, people, but like, it was a solvable problem compared to the discovery of audience, which I still feel is an unsolvable problem.
Okay, so if you can tell me more about that.
Yeah, so the problem that we faced that led to this hard reality that this cannot be scaled digitally as quick as we'd want to, was that, you know, until 2014, 15, 16, Facebook let you discover audiences based on, like, they were able to identify if somebody had disability and they would show your ads to them and so on and so forth. So it was easier to reach them. Google ads never worked for us beyond a certain demand. And I tell you why. Most people who are with disability don't look for matchmaking as an option. Like, what we had to do was primarily drive the awareness that you could find someone. And once they believed that they could find someone, only then they would really install the app. So in that loop, like, intent-based, you know, matching may Google never worked. So Facebook was our only option to actually scale this digitally back then. So we for 3 years or 2 years, we ran like 300, 400 experiments, which helped us discover this particular, and the CAC was still very, very high, but we still figured like this is the formula that works. What happened in 2017, around 2017 end, is this whole Cambridge Analytica blew up, and one after another, like these instances came up, and Facebook said you could no longer either ask someone about their disability or market it. So we would not have that algorithm at all in place, which meant now, of course, from whatever, anywhere our CAG was like 150, 200, it already like shot up. It was more blanket. You just like throw the blanket to 100 people and hope that 5 of them would have a disability or would require your app because of certain decisions that they made. So that was one set. And the second set was these meetups and discovering was purely based on who attended the meetup would hopefully know another person or two with disability, which was actually not the case. So in India, if you have disability, you would beyond one or two, you would, and unless you went to the same training center or you're part of the same NGO, you would not know a lot of people with disability. So Kedar, if you are a design lead, you would know people in design otherwise. Like, you'd have a community of designers to reach out to if you wanted to like promote Dribbble or something that you found really cool, right? We mm-hmm. don't have that. So if for example Payal has a disability and she loves the app and she found someone, even if she posted on social media and put a banner on her wedding stage, people, even after all of that, she would still be able to reach only 2 more people with disability who would like that or who would be interested in something like that. So you have to first make sure they have a disability, they found someone. If they have a disability and they're not already married, then you want to make sure they have a smartphone. We have sufficient profiles in their radius to be able to kind of show them. And then also that they have the intent of finding someone. When all these permutation combinations match, then you also have to make sure that they're able to strike a conversation, which means their disabilities kind of... So if I am hearing impaired and you're blind, we can never talk in physical space for very similar reasons. Like, yeah, I'm using sign language and you can't see my hands. So all these permutation combinations, and they're like 17, 18 of them at some cases that have to go right for me to be able to actually enjoy the success or virality of your success, which was disastrous in my view for us. So expensive CAG for somebody who lived with like a crore of funding, that's it, and 7 years, and then Facebook banning advertisements, all of one thing after another, the mountain kept falling off till the point we realized discovery of audience has to be now only NGO driven, that's it. And NGOs also are highly fragmented. So each NGO would go to, you have to have a top-down approach. Once you have a top-down approach and are actually able to bring sufficient trust in the stakeholders' mind, you still get a database of 25 people, for example, after doing all of that.
Wow, what a journey it must have been. I can hardly imagine.
Yeah, and everything. We've gone to classrooms in National Association of Blind. We've given classes. We've told them how this works. But in the end, it came to, sure, this is great and I'd love to find someone and I know how this works, but I don't have a house of my own. I live in a hostel and I'm never going to be employed. How do I find someone? So, like I said, the permutation combinations went for perpetuity for me to never be able to enjoy the virality of somebody actually meeting, telling someone I got married, and then 25 people came along, which I think the other matrimonial websites and dating apps, including Tinder, Bumble, everyone enjoys. If I met someone on Tinder, 5 of my friends can use Tinder to meet someone now. So yeah, that's the hard reality that at 21 I didn't know about. Like, I wish I thought about all these things back then, and I think it would have, I would have solved for this first before venturing or putting any other money anywhere else.
Yeah, so it's very interesting. I mean, it would be very interesting to know that, like, how has your definition of equality has changed? I mean, we'll conclude this particular section with this more abstract question of, like, yeah, I mean, in last 8-10 years or maybe 20-30 years, how has your definition of inequality or equality has changed?
Yeah, that is an abstract one. But, and I have one contrarian stand at it as well. For me, it's very simple. Equality is that you have the choice to be able to do something. Even if it means choice to want to live unequally, that's still a choice. But it's just simply put, it's like a choice to be able to do something that everyone else gets to do is equality for me. But a contrarian view that was very eye-opening, and I don't know if it still stands, but back in the day, was that most people think of inequality, I'm trying to frame this right, think of inequality as something that has to prevail like a food pyramid in this ecosystem. I forgot whether I read this or somebody told me this about, you know, the whole thing ke agar raja ka beta raja nahi banega to kya karega kinds. Yeah, or raja ka beta raja nahi banega, you know, then who would or who is even capable of, right? And I figured that most of it think that way because I went to attend a wedding, an in-club wedding, and I do remember that it was almost when this guy had, you know, he's from a very good background. He almost had the sense of entitlement of finding a bride even when he had a disability and the bride didn't. I don't know. I'm not able to, like, my neural links are not connecting right now on being able to articulate this to you like how it's in my brain. But most people, what I'm trying to tell you is most people think that this is a good, this is fine to have in our society. And hence, you know, it's a much tougher thing to fight.
Wow.
Most people say they don't like inequality, but like I feel their actions are very different. Even here, I live in Bandra. Even here, like most very educated people say they want equality, but they treat their house help in a very, very different manner. And which is what I'm trying to tell you, that this has to persist for them to be able to be entitled to what they are.
Yeah. I mean, even I was having a chat with one of the friends, I think maybe a couple of months ago. And what we figure out is that we actually pay about less than 1% of our salaries to our house help. I mean, and still we are talking about equality. And I mean, that's at least the state in which I am doing right now. And it puts me in a question to say that, is it fair? Is it fair? I mean, it is actually the entire nexus is designed to keep the people lower in the pyramid, make sure that they still they continue and they enjoy and they feel blessed if someone above them picks them up. I mean, the entire thing is staged. Yeah, right. It feels very weird to think on those lines. Yeah. Anyway, so that will digress. Moving on to the design part of it, I have just a couple of questions.
Sure.
Was there any conscious effort or decisions you made to keep the app also accessible? Any insights or any nuances?
A lot. So retrospective accessibility is very complicated. Like Twitter tried it for a really long time. So they were really inaccessible when they'd launched. But then if you can put image description to your images and so on. So they've tried. They have a separate vertical called Accessible Twitter or something to make Twitter accessible as an interface. But it's very tough because all your code is already written, probably not labeled for the voiceover to be able to read it. which we didn't want. So we started labeling everything, right from our buttons, everything actually, to the extent that if you didn't want to see the visual, and you'd get it because you're hosting this podcast. If you didn't want to read the visual, you could just put your voiceover on Google Talkback on, and the app would read you in a way that you've hit home. This is Raj's profile. He's 6'1". He lives in Kanpur. He has this disability. Tap to add him, and then you add him, and then the chat would start. Whatever. So we'd make sure that if you were not using this app visually, you could still listen to the whole app, so on and so forth. So different other disabilities that was tested, you could use this app in multiple ways if your wish, if you don't want to use one senses or the other. The only feature we did not have for a really long time, and if we had existed longer, we would have had, is the in-call feature. But most people had WhatsApp calls by then, and they could have shared their phone number. But otherwise, except the hearing part, we made sure retrospectively everything was tested for voiceover first. Including our website, it had to be accessible. Colors had to be selected by a certain means that we made sure that, you know, our first website actually was much more accessible, very ironically, than our last website. Our first one also had the black and white contrast, everything basically for any kind of person to be able to use it as seamlessly, irrespective of their physical challenges. So, but the core would be that labeling each code that most people forget in a way that makes sure that every piece of word is actually audible as well, was not a thing before Alexa and before voice became a thing, which is like hardly 3 years back.
Interesting. I stumbled upon a website called bookmybuy.com. I don't know, it's a Book My Show ripoff. But yeah, Book My Buy. And
saves. I'm sorry, I just actually made this joke.
So yeah, in that, when you start entering your details and the request which you have, it's quite extensive that, they go as granular as saying that, okay, is the person who's going to come as a house help, do you need sort of a, like, are there older people in the house, like how old they are, do you need person who can change their diaper, I mean that granular level details. And I don't think so that although they are capturing everything, but how algorithmically these matches are made is something which I have questioned. But in your case, you've also mentioned that you matched people manually on medical condition or lifestyle choices or cure availability. So if you can just give that, like, some insights about that, what was it about?
Yeah, so initially it was manual. After like 3 or 4 years of this,
even in manual, how did that happen?
Let's do it with examples. It's much easier. So if I if I have a kidney, I had people who didn't have kidneys. Okay, like both of them missing. One of them missing and had to go for transplant. This person in particular wanted a partner who has a DNA match so that she could give one kidney to him if she's opened. Of course, it's her choice, but that he were able to function much better, basically. And so on and so forth. Like, there were people who, let's say, again, I'm taking the same example for the ease of contextual understanding. This person had a kidney transplant done, wanted to make sure the other partner also came from a very similar background so that they could understand each other's lifestyles. Like, they can't take really long 6-hour drive and travel the world and all of those expectations that usually people would have from their partners. So this person had a very specific criteria that if you can get me somebody who's also had a kidney transplant, I feel this match is more compatible because of our food habits that have to be similar. We are not allowed to eat a certain items because of our lifestyle, like dialysis and resources. Everything that goes into is much similar. We both have constraints on long-term travel, all of that. So you get the point. Similarly, there were people, and I was amazed that in this journey, I could also see somebody highly autistic actually also getting married. This is the first person I had encountered when I started matchmaking physically, like face to face, and then everything moved digital. So her mom's still in touch with me, and she's actually got all the credit, not me. But like, I saw somebody with autism get married to somebody who's a teacher, a professor by profession. That's a very good match, because autistic guys are very good at research, at patterns, at certain things that their skill set is, and they're not very good at being social, communication, all of that is not their best traits. He found someone who's a professor and with hardcore research, which means he had a very complementing abilities, and that person also didn't enjoy speaking too much, didn't enjoy a social lifestyle, all of that. So it was a good match, and she didn't have to be autistic for that, but you have to just look for these traits, right? That's what I meant when I said matching complementing abilities. And the cure availability part is the transplant part that I was talking about. If somebody has no chance of transplant and doesn't have a kidney, probably wants to go for somebody also who doesn't have kidneys, because they both are mentally prepared. One of them may not live very long. So that's what I was talking about when I said like they're cured.
Okay. No, yeah, but how do these match happen? I mean, they are giving you these details and you are noting them, and then you are probably waiting for someone with similar thing, and then you are actually going through this database and then matching them?
In the physical world for 2014 and 2015 year, that's how it happened. 2017-18, we were highly optimized with the use of technology and algorithms on the back end. Like, they had to input all this data, but we were able to feed in this information of if this, then that, already for most use cases. But that could only happen like 4 years into the journey.
That's amazing, Aaron. I think this can just go on and on for me. It's so inspiring and so very close to me in terms of the philosophy of getting to the grassroots level and trying to do something worthwhile. Given the time span people have already, I think we have generally I conclude it in an hour, but it's fine. Who helped you in designing and developing it? If you can give like a good shout out to them, remembering them after 2 years, 1 year.
Yeah, so the tech side and everything. So we didn't have a product manager or a UX consultant or a designer, okay, for like 6 years. So this is one backend guy, one UI designer, UI frontend guy, me and Shankar. So Saurabh, Ravin and Shankar are actually the three people on the app side that made it together. And then on the other side of the physical spaces, which is social spaces, it was Ajit, Rahul, and Shankar who made sure that so design is not just digital, right? For us, design was much more also the physical space where 100 people were supposed to come together, and we had to make sure everything's in a way where they don't touch a chair or fall off, or if they are in a bar, and we threw parties in a bar as well, that they could keep they could use, if they are on wheelchair, they could have a space to keep their drinks at an equidistant and not at the bar, which is much elevated level example. So design wise, physical and tech wise have taken all the names, and actually we were very thick, and we were a very small team of 10 people who stayed through put end to end, like till the last day when the office was dismantled and everything, they stayed through. So those are these guys. And yeah, I mean, I'd always cherish this. I feel so uninspired after that. I've never been, unfortunately, I'm very uninspired after InClub closed down. There were so many people that I'm telling you, maybe you edit later, but for you, like where I gave these talks and I got down and they would tell me, you're so lucky that you found your purpose. And I would wonder, what are they talking about, right? You're like 24, you don't get it. But now I get what they were saying when they said, oh, you're so lucky to be able to find something that really inspires you.
So, yeah. I'm not going to edit this. I think we'll just conclude, because there's so much to talk. But I don't know how to thank you for sharing this all information, and hopefully this stays in and this helps someone and gets more inspiration to do for these differently abled people.
Yeah.
All the best in your journey. It was really, really wonderful talking to you, and thanks a lot.
Thanks for your time as well, and I hope everyone enjoys this.
Yes, definitely. Enjoys this other, I would say, inspires this and drives more empathy if possible.
Okay, then.
Cool. Thank you. That's it.
And that's it from today's Gyan session. Catch us on iTunes, Saavn, Stitcher or any podcasting app you use. Do rate us on iTunes and follow us on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. Stay tuned for more Gyan on audiogyan.com. Till then, bye.
At Speedway, we've always been here to get you what you need when you need it. We're committed to keeping our stores open, clean, and safe, so you can stay fueled and refreshed all summer long. We've got cold drinks for hot days and frozen drinks for even hotter ones, plus energy boosts, quick bites, and pick-me-ups. We're always on your way, and we're always here for you. So no matter what you need, when you stop by, we'll be ready. Now, any Speedy Freeze up to Mighty Size is just 99 cents.